Hi everyone, I have some really great news. Court Junkie has just scored another sponsor, Lifeway Kefir. And I know what you're thinking, this is just another ad that I'm being forced to promote. But so far, I've actually had the really good fortune of being able to choose all of my advertisers. In other words, I go to them because I'm already a customer and because I already love them. I went to Lifeway Kefir and I told them about this podcast, and I asked them if they would be interested in sponsoring me, and they agreed. So, what's Lifeway Kefir, you ask? First of all, chances are you may have already seen them in your grocery store. Kefir is a creamy and delicious cultured dairy drink that's a healthier, more convenient cousin of yogurt. They have all sorts of great nutrients you need, and best of all, they're 99% lactose-free. Look for Lifeway Kefir in the dairy case at your favorite local grocery store and visit lifewaykefir.com for coupons. That's Lifeway, K-E-F-I-R.com. Hi, this is Jillian, and welcome to today's Court Junkie Brief on Expert Witnesses. As a reminder, I'll be releasing these briefs periodically about singular courtroom-related topics. And don't worry, these are in addition to my regular episodes. But for these, I'll be speaking with legal experts, pathologists, attorneys, etc., to learn more about the different aspects of our justice system. The format for these will be a little bit more casual than my normal episodes, and they'll have more of an interview feel. Today's topic is all about expert witnesses. But first, as always, I want to thank all of you for listening. If you like the show, please subscribe so that you get new episodes right to your feed. And if you really like the show, please leave me a review on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever it is that you're listening from. And if you really, really like the show, please consider donating as little as a dollar a month at patreon.com/courtjunkie. Now on to the episode. So, I have a confession. Because I follow so many trials and criminal court cases, I actually have a favorite expert witness. As you know if you follow these types of cases too, oftentimes high-profile cases will use the same experts. Think Michael Bodden, Henry Lee, Cyril Wecht, etc. And so, if you're a little weird like I am, you might just latch on to a favorite. But, admittedly, I don't know much about how expert witnesses work. How do attorneys find them? What sort of credentials make them experts? And are some of them really credible? And what is an expert witness exactly? Well, first, it helps to know that the United States has something called the Federal Rules of Evidence, which are a set of rules that govern the introduction of evidence at civil and criminal trials in the United States federal trial courts. Rules 701 through 706 deal with expert testimony, and simply put, they essentially say that a qualified expert can give his opinion to help the court understand evidence or to establish a fact and issue. Now, these are federal rules, so any states that have not adopted these generally have similar rules or statutes about this. To get a better understanding of how expert witnesses work, I spoke with Russ Richelsoff, a criminal defense attorney in Tempe, Arizona, and I asked him everything I could possibly think of about how he uses expert witnesses. Russ is a partner at Davis Miles McGuire Gardner, and he does everything from DUI cases to drug cases to white-collar crimes. If you could kind of walk us through the process, how do you find expert witnesses for a criminal case?
Well, probably the number one way that I have found expert witnesses, and it's really the preferred way to find expert witnesses, is the referral. What I do is I reach out to my network of fellow criminal defense attorneys, and I say, hey, I need an expert who's an accident reconstructionist. I need a forensic accountant. I need a criminalist, you know, whatever it is, and see who my friends and colleagues recommend. That's really the best place to get an expert, and really the best place to really find anybody is through a recommendation from somebody that you respect and trust. You have to also pay attention to the clients and what they're able to pay.
Mm-hmm.
So some clients are going to be able and willing to pay to fly in an expert from out of town who's going to be more expensive. Some clients just don't have that kind of money, so you need to stick with the local people. The local people are not bad. It's you really need somebody who has experience for what you're trying to accomplish, what you're trying to convey to a jury. An expert witness is really a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
Their job is to explain the whatever scientific or technical information that you need to explain to the jury. They really need to teach the jury. They need to do a good job of explaining it in a way that at the end of the day, the jury is going to understand it. And that's the real important role of an expert witness. Obviously, we have cases where there's a difference of opinion. In those situations, jury's going to go with who they think is right, who they think is more credible, and who they believe at the end of the day.
So what about compensation, and how do you get that approved by the client?
Usually I have a general idea of what the client's budget is already, and then I'll reach out to the appropriate expert. I'll explain the case to them, and then I always ask, how much money do you think this is going to cost? And then I go back to the client and say, if we want to hire this person, this is how much they're estimating it's going to cost. Most experts charge hourly, so you get their hourly rate and then an estimate of how many hours they expect it's going to take. You know, the estimates are their estimates, so it's not carved in stone. But usually we get enough money from the clients. We hold the money in trust. So that way we can ensure that the experts will get paid.
And that includes like travel for them too, right?
Yeah, it can include travel expenses, you know, airfare, hotel, things like that.
Leah from our Court Junkie Facebook group wanted to know how much experts get paid. And that amount definitely varies, but I've read from about $240 an hour to well in excess of $1,000 an hour. Not a bad gig if you're an expert in one of these fields. Something else I've always wondered, and something that Catherine, another member from our Facebook group, brought up, is what sort of credentials are needed for somebody to be deemed an expert? It sounds like you would need to be pretty well established and have a lot of certifications, right? Well, not exactly. And then what kind of credentials are needed for somebody to be deemed an expert?
It's different fields are different. So one field, which you may want somebody with a PhD and research experience, in another situation, I had a case, this is years ago, I had a case with an individual who was accused of driving a bulldozer across state trust land. And there were plants on the state trust land that were damaged when he drove the bulldozer across it. And so the issue in the case was, what was the value of this damage? You know, what should the restitution be in the case? And I found a nursery in town, you know, a plant nursery in town,
mm-hmm.
that specialized in native plants and sold native plants. And I had someone from the nursery come in and testify. They didn't really have a PhD in plants,
mm-hmm.
but they did have experience and they were recognized as somebody who, you know, knew what they were talking about. And so that's really what it comes down to, is does your expert have an expertise in the field? Are they recognized as having expertise in the field? Are they going to be credible on this particular topic? The expert I used, they were a person who ran a business that sold these plants and could credibly talk about these plants. So in that particular case, that was an expert. In other cases, you might want people who are, like I said, credentialed, who've written journal articles, things like that. It just depends on the situation. An expert really can be anybody who just has specialized knowledge that relates to the case, you know, it's relevant to the case, and they're qualified to talk about it. What is qualified, you know, just depends on the area of specialty and what exactly we need the expert for.
Right. And then do both sides need to agree that expert is in fact an expert?
They don't need to agree. So it can happen one of two ways. Certainly the sides can stipulate that the person is an expert. The other way that you can do it is that you would lay the foundation for your expert. And once you've completed laying the foundation for your expert and their expertise, ask the court to declare your witness an expert witness. It could go either way.
And there's no set standard set by the court?
It just depends on the area of expertise. I mean, you could be an expert on podcasts, you know, how to set up a podcast, how to do it. You have experience doing it before. You've done it before. All I need to do is to ask you questions that demonstrate that you do have experience and have some kind of specialized knowledge about how to operate a podcast, and you could be considered an expert by the court.
Hopefully, I will never be called as an expert witness. Because to be honest with you, just thinking about being cross-examined by somebody like Juan Martinez, the Jodi Arias prosecutor, kind of gives me anxiety. I'm going to take a little break here and tell you more about why I love our new sponsor, Lifeway Kefir. Not only are they tasty little dairy drinks, but they're healthy too. In just 8 ounces, you get 11 grams of all-natural protein, 12 different probiotics, 30% of your daily calcium requirement, and like I said earlier, they're 99% lactose-free. I started drinking them a few months ago, and I absolutely fell in love with them. I usually drink one in the morning, but sometimes I'll have one as dessert, too, because I kid you not, they are that tasty. So look for Lifeway Kefir in the dairy case at your favorite local store, and visit lifewaykefir.com for coupons. I'll also be doing some giveaways with them in the next couple of weeks in our Facebook group, so be on the lookout for that too. Now back to expert witnesses. Another thing I've always wondered is how experts are told to prepare for trial.
I always ask my experts two questions. I always ask my experts, what questions should I ask you? And then the second question I ask them is, what questions should I not ask you?
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. You know, good expert witnesses are not shills. You know, they're not giving you the opinion that you want just because you're paying them. They're giving you an authentic opinion. You know, the expert is going to answer the questions that they're asked. As the attorney, you may not have as good a depth of knowledge. You're definitely not going to have as good a depth of knowledge of the subject matter as the expert is. So it's helpful to sit down with the expert and, you know, ask them, what questions should I ask you? Because what you're getting is, what's the important information about this particular issue? What is it that you need to explain to the jury that's going to have them understand this from our point of view? And so really the expert's the one who's best qualified to figure out to know what information needs to be conveyed to the jury. And certainly, you know, the attorney works with the expert and will, sometimes the expert will say something that's very technical. I know it's technical because I'm not an expert in the field, but to the expert, it's just, that's normal every day. So I'll ask them to explain it or expand it, or sometimes they'll use a word that's too big. I'll ask them, when you use this word, what does that mean? So it's very collaborative. But usually I pay very close attention to what the experts have to say about what information that they believe the jury should hear.
And then what does the expert themselves need to do? Like, don't they need to like write a report? Is that right?
Yeah, so generally what happens is we provide the expert with as much information about the scenario as we can. Based on that information, sometimes they'll do outside research. I've done cases involving pharmacology, and I have a professor of pharmacology at one of the local medical schools that I've used in court before. In advance, I'll give her information about the medications that are involved, and she'll go do research. You know, she'll check the FDA, apparently keeps records of the research that was done and side effects of certain medications and things like that. And so she'll go look at the studies and see, you know, what do the studies say? That way, she's prepared to come to court and testify about this medical school did a study with this medication and this is what they found. You know, she'll have specific event. The experts are not expected to just know everything off the top of their head. Just like attorneys, they get a scenario and they'll go research the information and then be prepared to give feedback. So usually first step before you even disclose the expert to the other side is you have a conversation with the expert and say, hey, here's a scenario I have. Here's what I'd like to do. Can you help me with this? Is there positive information that's going to, you know, is what you're going to be able to say in court, is it going to help us? And the experts will go do research. They'll write a report, disclose a report to us. And then if the report is favorable, if the report is favorable and we intend to use the expert in court, then we disclose the report to the other side and, you know, give them an opportunity to interview our expert prior to the trial.
And what about cross-examining an expert witness? In some of the trials that I've followed, and again, the Jodi Arias case could apply here too, the cross-examinations were pretty brutal. So is it always about discrediting the expert witness on cross-examination? Russ says that that's not always the case.
You know, cross-examination in television shows and on the movies is very exciting and it's very adversarial. Cross-examination in real life can be like that, but it's not always like that. And sometimes on cross-examination, when you're questioning an expert, sometimes you're trying to bring out other information. I did a cross-examination of a DNA expert with regards to semen in a crime scene, and they're trying to prove that this semen belongs to this individual who is accused of rape. My cross-examination, though, was more about that the presence of semen has no relevance to the whether or not there was consent. So all we can say is that there was a sexual act, but we don't know the nature of that sexual act. So that's a situation where the prosecutor has to prove every element of their case, including identity. So they're going to go through those steps, but we don't always challenge every element of the case. You know, our theory of the case may be this was a consensual encounter. So the presence of his semen is expected. That's not something that we're challenging, and we just want to bring out that the presence of semen doesn't necessarily mean that a rape occurred. It just means that a sexual act occurred. It has no bearing on consent or not consent.
So, and I'm sure you've heard this before too, but I know that a lot of people think that expert witnesses aren't necessarily credible because they're paid witnesses. And I just wanted to get your thoughts on that. And then how do you make sure that your expert witness isn't just telling you what you want to hear?
Well, I hire experts who are credible. I don't think any attorney wants to hire an expert just because they're going to say what you want them to say, because it's not going to work in court. That can be, you know, the expert's prior testimony can be brought up. So, you know, experts have your reputations. Mm-hmm. When somebody is an expert witness for a living, when I'm pulling the guy who works at the nursery, you know, the plant nursery, he's never testified in court before, so he's not a professional expert witness. When I'm using a pathologist, a criminalist, a gunshot residue expert, whatever, you know, these experts, they have reputations. And if their reputation is as somebody who just will say whatever needs to be said for money, they're going to have a problem getting hired. So I really don't think most experts who testify in court for a living will say anything and are paid whores, essentially. I really don't think that's the scenario. In the courtroom, sometimes on cross-examination, the other side will try to bring up that the expert is being paid to be there. But that's something that I deal with that on direct examination. That's something I reveal to the jury as part of my testimony. Sir, you are a criminalist. This is your history. You worked for the state crime lab, and when you worked for the state crime lab, you were paid to testify in court for the state, correct? Yes. And now you've left the state crime lab. Yes, you've retired. Yes. And now who do you work for? Well, I usually do work for both sides. And when you testify in court, you get paid to do that. Yes. Do you always get paid to do that? Yes. Why do you get paid to do that? Well, this is how I feed my family. Juries, I don't think, have the negative reaction to experts that you're, at least that hasn't been my experience.
Gotcha. So I've noticed, especially in the sort of cases that I follow, such as capital cases, that some of the experts on cross-examination come off to me as being very defensive And I always wondered to myself, is there anything in it for them? Like, are there any consequences for them if they don't testify how they said that they would? Or if under cross-examination, the other side gets something out of them that you weren't aware of? I mean, I guess what I'm asking is, are there any consequences at all regarding their testimony?
No, I mean, they don't get paid contingent on whether you win or lose. You always want to, and that kind of goes back to the two questions I ask experts. What questions should I ask you? What questions shouldn't I ask you? The second question, what questions shouldn't I ask you? You're trying to find out what bad information there is about the case. Maybe there's a research study that's counter to, you know, what the expert is saying. That's something that it would be better to know about in advance and address it in direct examination. Sir, you have an opinion about this. Your opinion is based off of this study. Yes. Are you're aware that there's this other study that's different from what you're saying? Yes, I am. Have you reviewed that study? Yes, I have. Why is your opinion different than this study? Well, let me explain the methodology of the study. I don't agree with how they did the study. Here are the flaws that I think in this particular study. So you can, it's really best to try to avoid surprises on cross-examination and address that stuff on direct examination instead. But, you know, if you do get surprised by something, that could be a couple of things. It could be, you know, poor preparation on the part of attorneys. Not every attorney asks their expert, what questions shouldn't I ask you? I think that's a very important question. But time and time again, I've seen attorneys ask questions that they shouldn't ask their expert, and they get an answer that doesn't help their case. So I think it's important to know and talk to your expert about the weaknesses in advance so you're not surprised by something that comes up on cross-examination. But there's no consequence to the expert. It's their reputation.
Have you ever experienced any issues with an expert witness before? Like, for example, did their testimony maybe not go the way that you thought it would, or, you know, anything like that?
I do a lot of self-defense cases, and I have actually used the opposing police officers as use of force experts.
Really? What do you mean the opposing police department? Oh, like,
so I'll have a police officer who, you know, it's a use of force case. I did a case last year. My client was accused of pointing a gun at five individuals in a parking lot of a bar. Our version of the events was that he was defending himself. Here in Arizona, you can display a firearm if somebody's threatening you. The laws are different in different states. Arizona is a very gun-friendly culture and very permissive use of firearms for the purpose of self-defense. So in this particular situation, I had my client was accused of pointing a firearm at people. He was accused of disorderly conduct, dangerous, for recklessly displaying a firearm. And as you can imagine, a lot of police officers responded. You know, when somebody has a gun in the parking lot of a bar, everybody who's wearing a uniform that night shows up. One of the police officers who testified happened to be a use of force and range instructor for the police. So on cross-examination, I used him as my use of force expert. I know, you know, I'm familiar with use of force. He was a hostile witness, but again, even as a hostile witness, he wants to maintain his credibility, and we didn't pay him for his testimony. But when you ask a police officer who teaches use of force to other police officers, if he has experience and is an expert in the use of force, of course he's going to say yes. And the prosecutor is usually not going to challenge you on that. So there have been a couple of occasions where I've used the opposing side's witnesses as my expert witnesses. And what being an expert witness does is allows them to give an opinion. Most witnesses are allowed to come to court and give information about what they saw and heard. An expert witness is special because they're allowed to give an opinion. So I've found that little, I don't want to call it a trick necessarily, but it definitely catches the prosecutors that I've done it with. It's definitely caught them off guard. Mm. And I'm using the opposing side's witness as my own expert to convey information that helps my case. That doubly helps me because the jury isn't even questioning credibility of the police officer when they're cross-examination and they're testifying the way I want them to. So,
is there anything else you'd like to add about this subject that you think might be interesting, like to the layperson, maybe that we don't know about expert witnesses?
You know, the thing to remember is that not every case is the O.J. Simpson or Jodi Arias case.
Right.
You know, there are a lot of cases out there that are just, you know, regular, ordinary people who've been accused of crimes. And so as an attorney, you definitely have to, you know, act within your client's budget. And so you can't always fly in the international expert from Europe on, you know, DNA analysis. Sometimes you just have to use what you have. But oftentimes it's sufficient. You know, oftentimes there is a local expert who is good at what they do, who is recognized as an expert in their field and who can help you. So, you know, a lot of these cases, the high profile cases are the ones that get everybody's attention. But, you know, there's a lot of cases that are taking place in a courtroom with no real audience that are just
right,
except for the jury.
Right.
And so it's you have to, as an attorney, you have to adapt to the situation and, you know, make do with the witnesses that your client can afford.
Yeah, that makes sense. You mean every case is not like the Jodi Arias case?
Yeah, no, not every case is the Jodi Arias case. Thank God.
So that's all for today's brief on expert witnesses. I hope you enjoyed it and hope you all learned something. I want to thank Russ Richelsoff for speaking with me and educating me on expert witnesses. And thanks to all of you for listening. Don't forget to join our Court Junkie discussion group on Facebook if you haven't already. We talk about everything from these episodes to our favorite true crime documentaries to interesting court cases we come across. So don't miss out. Thanks for listening, and until next time.